better living through algorithms. Or at least that's what we thought. What happens when biases like sexism or racism are baked into the algorithm, even unconsciously? This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton talks with an author who has researched the inevitable biases that happen when humans code. And that conversation starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. The tech lash that's been building all year long, triggered largely by the Facebook / Cambridge Analytica scandal, is showing no signs of abating. If anything, it's gaining steam. The calls for oversight and regulation of mega tech companies are growing louder. On this show, we've drilled into just how biases like sexism and racism can get baked into algorithms, even unintentionally. But recently, that aspect of how we use and interface with our technology has been seen more through a human behavior lens. We're finding concrete examples of bias, not just theoretical.
For example, you go back a few years ago to something like, you know, when Apple Health launched, right? And they launched that product saying it's going to track all of your health metrics that matter. And they launched it without having a period tracker. Mm-hmm. That is a huge oversight in terms of which health metrics matter.
The trouble with tech and what to do about it. Here we go.
Sarah Wachter-Betcher, and I'm the author of Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech.
Well, let's just land right there on the title, Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms. We've had other authors on. Your take on this is really strong. Let's just start with why you wanted to write this book in the first place.
Yeah, you know, it really came out of my work working with tech companies and working with people in a lot of different roles in the tech industry, where I felt like my peers and I weren't talking enough about the ways that the things that we design and build could hurt people, or the ways that our own biases or sort of limited viewpoints about who and what is normal were getting baked into the things we're designing. So I was seeing that in conversations I was having with product design and engineering teams. And a couple of years ago, that led me to start talking about that within the industry. And what I realized is that while I think it's really important to talk to folks who work in tech, I also wanted people who didn't work in tech to feel like this was accessible to them, was something they could understand and also talk about. And that's what led me to writing Technically Wrong.
Cool. Well, you know, and the subtitle for your book is so strong. I kind of want to live here for a second because sexist apps is the first mention in the subtitle. And, you know, going back to about 2000 when the bust happened, the Wall Street bros decided to become tech bros, and a wave came across Silicon Valley with a lot of extra money looking for something to do rather than be on Wall Street. Are the sexist apps a result of the tech bro culture? Is it a lack of awareness, or is it something more willful?
Well, I think it's a few things, and I certainly think that the lack of diversity in the tech industry has substantially contributed to problems of bias being built into technology. I mean, for example, you go back a few years ago to something like, you know, when Apple Health launched, right? And they launched that product saying it's going to track all of your health metrics that matter. And they launched it without having a period tracker. Mm-hmm. That is a huge oversight in terms of which health metrics matter and for whom, because it turns out a lot of people have periods, and not including that in some product that is meant to be this sort of like all-encompassing health product is just a huge, massive oversight, right?
Yeah.
And I look at that and I think, okay, a big piece of that is certainly coming down to who was in the room when design decisions were being made, who was being considered as primary audience, whose feedback was deemed important. All of those things would contribute to something like that happening. But I also think that some of it is a reflection of societal bias at large, right? I mean, I think it's not just that tech decided to not serve, let's say, women. That's something that you can see in lots of kinds of products. I mean, you can see it in things like car safety going back decades, where crash test dummies were always men and car safety was always gauged against whether it was going to harm a man and not necessarily a woman. And that caused our cars to actually be much more fatal for women drivers. And so I want to be clear that part of this is definitely coming from a lack of diversity within tech specifically. Part of it is coming from a reflection of societal biases. But the real issue is that the more powerful tech becomes, the more we are embedding tech in every little bit of our society,
right,
all of our most intimate interactions, the more we really need to take stock of this and actively work against it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, because the biased algorithms, the next part of your subtitle, frankly, do you think that people understand the amount of data being collected about them? And is there a way to raise that awareness?
You know, I think that it really depends who you're talking to. It's hard to understand because it is so much data, and the sort of overwhelmed feeling that people have when they try to think about all of the ways that they would have to opt out shuts it down most of the time. So a lot of times when you get into a conversation about something like data collection, people will say things like, oh, well, you just like quit using Facebook, which is all well and good. And not that Facebook is the only data collector by any means, but it's like, stop using Facebook, stop using Google, et cetera. And when people start looking at, okay, well, what would my life look like if I cut all of those things out that are collecting data, that all feels very overwhelming. And so I think that that's one of the reasons that people don't necessarily know as much about it as maybe they should, because it's often being painted as sort of like an individual moral choice, right? Like if you think this is bad, then you should just remove this from your life. Nice. And that's actually very difficult because the way we've built an entire societal infrastructure off of relying on these systems,
right.
That feels hard. And so I think that we need to be able to look at it in different ways. And so one of the things that, you know, that I've been trying to do is make it just easier to talk about and make it something we can talk about in language that is going to be a little bit more accessible and not immediately go back to our sort of like, you know, technical corners, which I think allows us to make things sound complicated and mystified for people.
Right, exactly. That's a great word, mystifying for people. And that's why I think for a while we were stuck as a culture, as a society, as a humankind in the golly gee whiz phase of the tech that we could have in our pockets in smartphones and online and each checking out at the grocery store. I mean, it just now with books like yours, you're helping us come out of that golly gee whiz phase and kind of be like, golly gee whiz, this kind of sucks that they have all this data on us and we just kind of gave it all away. Am I overstating that in your opinion? I mean, do you think that maybe it's time for us to pull back just a little bit on the societal repercussions of this tech?
I mean, I think that there has been a real tendency among the public to kind of look at new technology as a, you know, fun and shiny object and to focus in on the things that are cool or exciting about it. But that's not just people. I think that that's also been for a long time. That was what the tech press did. It's only in the last couple of years that you're starting to see more criticism coming from the tech press. And it's something that I think tech companies have really wanted, right? Like they want you to focus on, oh, wow, look at this cool thing, and not sort of like, you know, don't look at the man behind the curtain. Don't take a closer look at how we're able to do this and what kinds of like surveillance we rely on to be able to do this, what kinds of data sets and where that data came from that we rely on to be able to do this. I think that has been a way that I think the tech industry has been able to, in a lot of ways, you know, amass a lot of power and maintain sort of a sense of, for a long time, a sense of goodwill with people that like, for example, you know, like Wall Street doesn't have particular goodwill with the public,
right.
But tech did for a really long time. And I feel like that's starting to shift now because people are starting to see the tremendous downsides to the things we've created.
We're speaking with the author of Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. That's in paperback right now. And on page 115, and I didn't want to pop this on you, but you'll recognize it since you wrote it. Screens built to be tapped through as quickly as possible so you won't notice what you're agreeing to. Services that collect information based on proxy and use it to make often incorrect assumptions about you and quote-unquote delightful features designed to hide what's actually under the hood. I found that to be a really good summation of what you would call in your subtitle, Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Are there more examples that you could tease out from that? Because I think that we've touched on the sexism, we've touched on the algorithms a bit, but this other threats of toxic tech, it sounds nebulous to an extent, but there are some concrete points that we could pull out, right?
Yeah, so some of the stuff that I really talk about that I look at as being sort of parallel problems to issues like bias and algorithms is things like the way that design features like, let's say, all of those, you know, little Facebook features that encourage you to relive a memory from your past, right? So here's the most popular thing you posted 4 years ago. Here's a, you know, video we made you of all your top moments with your best friend that we decided is your best friend because of our algorithm. Those types of features, those are really features that are built to delight you, to up your engagement in the app, right? They want you to be using Facebook more often and feel good about it.
But dopamine hit,
working,
right?
Right, exactly. And that's going to keep you clicking and tapping along. But what that is really obscuring is a few things. One of them is some huge assumptions about you and who you are and what you care about. I mean, there are so many examples of things like those Facebook features going tragically wrong, where, you know, it's like, let's surface up the most traumatic memories of your past, pictures of your dead loved ones, and slap some fun illustrations on top of them and say, hey, here's your top memory, and having people, you know, be really hurt by that. I mean, there's tons of examples of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also all these other examples of sort of like attempts at engagement or delights that go astray, where it's what you really have is you have these tech companies that decide that they need to optimize, you know, how much time you're spending on their product, how many times you're visiting it in a day, are you a daily active user, are you a monthly active user? And in their quest to always be optimizing for that, there's not a lot of, you know, questions being asked about, well, at what cost? Or like, when is that actually not a good idea? Or how could that go wrong?
Right.
And so I think I always look at these sort of moments where an interface is designed to be quirky and fun and delightful. I think that that's always a flag to ask a deeper question, like, well, why are they doing that exactly? And what does that say about sort of their priorities when that goes wrong?
Okay, you're using a great rhetorical device there, as in, like, what's really behind this ask that we're opting into? Are there other ways? No. You know what? I don't want to ask you that. I want to ask you about regulation. Regulation follows innovation. There's a lot more noise happening around regulation on this. Do you have any thoughts about that? Is there a good way for us to move forward when it comes to maybe reining this in a bit and maybe understanding it a little bit better, maybe slowing it down a little bit even?
Tough about regulation is that we are not in a, I mean, we're not in a moment where regulation of tech feels particularly likely, even though there's a lot of stirring about it. I don't really see a ton of action happening in the immediate term. I think there's a number of problems. One of them is not necessarily having people in government who understand technology and understand sort of the actual impact that we're talking about here. So that's an issue. And I think that that's something that we should be paying a lot of attention to, you know, as the public, as we're thinking about who we want to elect and who we want to be representing us, whether or not they can have effective conversations about technology that are neither, you know, just glowing, ooh, everything's great conversations, nor everything is confusing and scary, which is those are the two kind of opposite ends of the spectrum I think we often end up at. Mm. I think that that's really important for us to get somewhere good with regulation. The other thing I would say is that I don't really think we will reach a point of getting any good types of regulation if the only people who are talking about it are industry and government. I think that you need to have the public talking about it and talking about it loudly and much more often, because without that voice in there, it's like whose voices are going to be represented in that regulation. So that's one of the reasons that I've been really focused on making sure that we can make this topic more accessible to the public.
Right.
So it isn't just, you know, your tech tycoons and your like older white guy senators talking about what the regulations should be.
Dude, they had to explain to Orrin Hatch how Facebook paid for itself, Senator.
You know, that was such an interesting conversation, because on the one hand, part of me was thinking like, no, make him sit there and explain that it's literally just advertising, because I think that that's, it's actually really, I thought that was on the one hand, like Orrin Hatch should know. But on the other hand, I'm like, a lot of people don't realize it's literally just advertising. And it's an incredibly lucrative form of advertising because of the amount of data that they're capturing about you, and because of the way that they have optimized that engine to make maximum revenue for advertisers with no consideration of the impact on the user.
That's right.
And I think that even though that was comical in some ways, I actually was really glad that interchange happened, because I thought it was very telling of just how much that reality is not clear to a lot of people. And
yeah.
I don't think it's just Orrin Hatch. I don't think it's just people who are older. I think that a tremendous amount of America doesn't really realize that.
I agree with you. And I was actually kind of heartened, too, that during the course of just this calendar year, the questions have gotten better coming out of Congress, coming out of the different hearings that tech has been showing up for on Capitol Hill, unless you're Google and then you don't go because you're trying to hide a data breach, whatever. Right. But you're right. I think that books like yours are helping us educate, because you said, you know, the consumers have to be in the conversation, not just government and tech. And that's great. But a functioning democracy, relies on an informed electorate, and we're just simply not informed right now. I think that what I read from your book about the terms of service that we all just click right through is incredibly important. I think that there is proof in that pudding. That is what's under the hood. How can we get people to read those terms of service and make sense of them, because they are written in such legalese?
Well, I don't think you can. I mean, that's the reality. You can read them. You can say, I am going to read end-to-end every terms of service that I sign up for. But would that solve the problem? Absolutely not. The average American does not have the reading level to be able to understand those and to just say, like, okay, I'm not comfortable with this, so I'm going to turn this down. I mean, that's just not realistic. I think the problem is that's the model we've created, where you can pack anything you want into that tier of service, send it out to the world, and you're covered. I mean, I don't think that you can, again, I don't think you can make this a matter of like pure personal responsibility. And that's what it ends up coming down to when it says, like, well, read the terms of service, right? Well, hey, I work on this stuff all the time. I have a very high level of literacy, and I cannot know all the implications of what I'm signing my life away to when I sign a term of service, right? Like, there's no way I can do that. So you're going to expect somebody who doesn't have the background that I have and is not necessarily like able to understand all of the language in there, you're going to expect them to do it? Well, no, that's obviously not true. Nobody expects that. And so I think that what we need to be asking is less about, you know, well, then why do they sign it anyway? Well, because they want to use the freaking app. Of course they do, right? They're human. I think we need to be asking, like, why are we allowing companies to create their entire world out of this model? And that is obviously, I think, a much harder problem to solve than trying to blame it on individual responsibility.
And I think we could add to this, we could put another brick in the wall if we would just stop using the phrase privacy as a catch-all, because it's not really about that. It's about apps doing naughty things with our data that we didn't know or intend. And there are apps to solve the problem with the apps. I did a search on TechCrunch before I called you for this interview. These stories go back 6-9 years. New Facebook iPhone app brings privacy bugs with it. What's another one? Clueful. So we're just adding on to the problem. We're trying to solve a problem with another problem, apparently. Do you have any suggestions when it comes to this? When it comes to what we just talked about, you said it's the impenetrable language used in terms of service agreements. Okay, fine. I'm with you on that. But we can't just leave it there. There's got to be a way around it. Is that just purely regulation?
So essentially, you want to know, what should an individual person do?
I guess. Because, I mean, we need a low lower barrier to entry, in my opinion, in order to crack some of this and start solving our own problems for ourselves, rather than rely on maybe an ill-informed Congress.
One of the places I always recommend that people start is just by taking stock. What are the things that you're using? Can you get a sense of what kind of data they're collecting? How much do you know about what they're doing? Do you know how they work? And also, do you need them? Do you know, is it really important to you? Why is it important to you? For example, you know, I know a lot of people who have done things like delete Facebook entirely. They've said, you know what, I've decided I don't need this.
Right.
I think for other people, things like that, that's not very realistic. I think it's also really important to say, I'm going to continue using this service for one reason or another, but I'm also going to critique it. And I fundamentally think it's okay to critique something that you're using. And in fact, it's really important to critique something that you use, to be able to say, hey, I'm a customer, and this here's feedback on the product that you're providing is, in fact, a completely normal and reasonable thing to do. And so sometimes I hear people say, like, well, if you don't like it, log off, right? And I think that that's actually not a very helpful answer. I think it's much more helpful to say, I don't like it, and here's why, and I want you to fix this, and to say that loudly and to make that part of the normal discourse. I think that, you know, what we need is, we need a culture that says, we're not just going to allow tech to get away with whatever it wants. There's going to be pushback. There's going to be consequences. And then I also think that within tech, and I think that this is a big thing, people who work in tech at every level, not just at the senior level, at every level need to be asking tough questions of themselves and their work, but also tough questions of their companies. Because I think that's also what you start seeing. You start seeing people organizing within a tech company and saying, no, we're not going to do this. And that being a difficult thing to do at first, but the more you practice that, the more that can take off and actually affect change. And I think if everybody remains sort of too scared to talk about it in their companies, I think that that's also a problem.
I think that's a very excellent point, as is the entire book, Technically Wrong. Sarah, really appreciate your time this morning. This has been a lot of education and a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sarah Wachter-Betcher. She's author of Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Sarah's other books include Design for Real Life and Content Everywhere. For links to the book and other references and all of our source material, please check out the show notes that go with this week's show. It lives online at KGORadio.com. Unless you're on the podcast, then it's in the show notes. And that's it for Techonomics this week. For executive producer Lee Hammer, I am the host and the writer, Jason Middleton. I want to thank my guest, Sarah Wachter-Betcher, and have great weeks, everybody.